Hi, everybody. My name is Pat Gallagher, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. And congratulations to the people who are celebrating birthdays today, and welcome to the newcomers. It's always really good for me to be here in this room, and it's funny because I'm a couple of months early. I usually come and share in April because my AA birthday is April Fool's Day, 1975, and I always think April Fool's is a really good day for me because the joke was on me. You know, we heard people reading the promises today, and I came here willing to just be miserable a day at a time for the rest of my life if I could just not drink. And I too, like Marge, had people say, God, you know, you just won't have enough time in a day to do all the things you want to do. And I thought, that's what you think. I mean, I was a periodic, and I was a binge drinker, and when I drank, it took long periods of time to recover, and it took long periods of time to try to deal with the chaos that I had created during that period. And I thought, I just don't know, I'm going to be so bored. I am just going to be sober, but that's okay. If that's what I have to do, I'll just be bored and sober. And I would come to meetings and I'd see people hugging each other and happy to see each other and that. And I thought, well, I was going to give a false name and be really anonymous. And I thought, and I'll keep my real life and my AA life separated. And, you know, part of that was that I always had a lot of compartments that I kept people in. You know, this person knew me this way, and this person knew me this way, and this person knew me this way. And one of the things that I hope my time in AA and my time working in this program has done is to make me be the same person with everybody. I mean, for the most part, I think I pretty much have learned how to be comfortable with myself and to stay centered in that, whether I'm in a work situation or whether it's with somebody in my family or with friends or even with people that I meet on the street. And I was thinking, too, about, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time today talking about what it was like before I got here. Kat has tapes that tell that. I can tell you that I was born into a family that was riddled with alcoholism, and I was orphaned twice, once by my mother's death and once by my father's alcoholism. And I was the eldest of three girls. And I was left with the responsibility and the promise that I would take care of them when my mother died. And I was a week past my eighth birthday. So when I found alcohol, it didn't do a lot of the things for me that I hear people talking about. What it did for me was it shut off the fear and it kept me kind of numb. I was always looking for, you know, I wasn't looking to be high. I just wanted to not feel. I wanted to not be afraid. And what I was thinking about when during the week, as I was thinking about coming over here today, I was thinking about some of the things that happened to me right in this room. And I wanted to share some of that today. And I want to spend some time telling you some of the things that I've learned during the time that I've been in recovery. I'm just getting over pneumonia, and it was really funny. I always think I'm so invincible. You know, I talk about denial. I heard an acronym for denial the other day. It's don't even know I am lying. Denial. And I can really get into denial when it comes to, you know, like physical stuff. I have this thing that if I'm sick, I'm guilty. Oh, I must have done something wrong. So I was walking around in a real sorry state, and finally God said, you know, we're going to get your attention, and I was just flat. And when my physician said to me, you know, this stuff kills people, it was like, oh. And then I started thinking, well, I wonder if I don't get over this thing, what would I want to say, you know, once I get enough energy to say anything. And I've been thinking about that during the week and how important some of the things are that I've learned here to me and how important they've been to people that I've worked with and sponsored over the years and that. And then that brought me back to thinking about this particular room. And I remember one time I was sitting in a chair over by the door there, and I was new in AA. I'd only been coming to AA for a couple of weeks, and maybe a couple of months. And I had been really happy once I got here. It was like, God, this is the answer. I was really scared that I was going to miss the one thing that was going to keep me sober, because I knew there was a secret, and some of you heard me talk about the nominating committee that I thought was watching me. to see if I was doing it right. I had this idea that that's why they ask you to introduce yourself, and then they can watch you and see. And if you're doing everything perfectly, and I wasn't sure if the probation period was 30 days or 90 days, and I was hoping it wasn't 90 because I knew I couldn't make it 90. And if you did everything exactly right, then they would give you the secret how not to drink. Because I couldn't believe it was as simple as people were saying at meetings. And the thing is, today I know that it is really simple. It's not really easy, but it's really simple. Do not drink. But I was real happy. I was, you know, for the most part, even with a lot of the sad things that have happened in the LIFE experiences, I have pretty much been happy in my sobriety. You know, I've stayed kind of on a, not exactly a pink cloud, but kind of a pastel pink, you know. And this particular weekend, I had gone to meetings, as was my custom. I went to lots and lots of meetings, and I still go to a lot of meetings. And people were talking about love. And I mean, that was the last thing I wanted to hear people talking about. And some of you may remember Betty Smith. She was chairing this particular meeting, and she always talked about love whenever she chaired a meeting or spoke anywhere. And I had known Betty and her husband. They had been friends of my dad's and were real, real important in my early sobriety. And I knew topic was love, and I knew Betty was going to call on me, and I was really a wreck. And sure enough, she did. And I got up and I started to cry, and I said, I can't tell you anything about love. I can tell you about fear, but I can't tell you about love. And what I really wanted to do was, before she called on me, was leave and run away, because that had been my pattern. I discovered when I was 8 years old that if I ran away, somebody fixed it. That was how I got involved with becoming a ward of the court. And I spent a lot of my childhood in foster homes and orphanages and juvenile hall and various and sundry institutions. And I was happy there, I'll tell you. You weren't supposed to be. It wasn't cool. But I was, because there was a consistency and a predictability about the situation. So anyhow, after this meeting, I went home, and this little voice inside said, this is getting too close for comfort. You better get the hell out of there. And I had been coming to meetings long enough to know what happens to people who quit going to meetings. And I thought, God, what am I going to do? And I thought, the best thing to do is just kill yourself. And because, see, that had always been an option, too. And I thought, you know, I mean, I asked God to remove the compulsion to drink. And now I'm not drinking, you know, and I'm not driven to drinking, so I guess I'll just kill myself. And I thought, I'm not getting out of bed, no matter what, and I'm not going to any more meetings, and I'm not calling anybody, So I thought, and if I do get up, I'm going into the closet in the fetal position, and that's it. This is it. And then this little voice inside said, you know, maybe you could ask God for help. And I thought, God, I don't even believe in God. But, well, what the heck, it worked once. So I said, okay, you know, God, please remove this compulsion to kill myself. And this little voice inside said, are you sure you really want to let go of this one? You know, because now I'm giving up a lot of options, okay? If I can't drink, if I can't take drugs, if I can't, you know, run away, if I can't kill myself, oh, my God, now what? I'm going to have to trust God. So I said, well, okay. And so then I said, I guess I better, you know, fall out of bed a little bit and get on my knees and ask God to remove this compulsion to kill myself. And I did, and he did. Now, that doesn't mean I haven't had moments over the years where that seems like it might still be an option. But it's the same kind of an option that when I get the idea that, gee, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. You know, I mean, I've been sober for a long time, and they have new pop kind of drink things out there now that, you know, they didn't have when I was drinking. Maybe I could drink that stuff, you know. But it's just like a train going through the station, you know. I just kind of let it go by and wave, and I don't hold on to that. So I came into this meeting, and, oh, I forgot. What happened was, while I was in the process of telling myself that I wasn't coming back here anymore, the phone rang. And it was a friend of mine in AA. And she said, do you want to go to the noon meeting? And I said, oh, no, I'm not going to any more AA meetings. And she said, I'll be right there. And sure enough, she was. And I mean, I literally came over here looking like, you know, the wrath of God. I didn't care about, you know, putting on any lipstick or comb or anything. I didn't even know if I had shoes on. But I got here. And I remember, you know, sitting there by the door, and whoever was chairing the meeting called on me, and I said, you know, I wasn't coming back here anymore. And it was like there was this gasp in the room, like, what? Because here, I mean, the day before and for those months previous, I had been in love with being in AA. And it was interesting because by my being there and by my sharing about asking for that compulsion to be removed, a couple of people came up to me after the meeting who had been going through the same kind of thing. And we talked about it, and as far as I know, we're all still here, you know, on the planet, anyhow. The other thing that happened was around that same time, the San Jose Mercury News had a treasure hunt contest. I don't know if any of you guys remember this. And they had clues in the paper about where the treasure was. And when I came to AA, I was a single parent with two little kids. I was getting no financial support from my ex-husband. I was working two and three different jobs at a time, and I was getting AFDC and food stamps. I used to go across town, the other side of town, to spend food stamps and I didn't tell anybody. I didn't share any of this stuff for a long, long time because I felt really ashamed, like somehow I was failing. So when I read this paper, I thought, that's it. I knew where that treasure was. I knew the clues. So I told the kids that when they were getting ready to go to school, I said, I don't know if I'll be here when you guys get home or not. And they said, why? And I said, well, because I'm going on this treasure hunt. Now, my kids are so great. I have two boys who are in their early 20s now, or one's actually in his mid-20s. He keeps growing up. And, you know, they've kind of grown up with just kind of a gentle amusement at mom's eccentricities. You know, one of them just celebrated 5 years clean and sober in October, and the other one has just always kind of been at home in the universe, and I don't really understand that. But they just kind of went, oh, you know, and of course the alcoholic wanted to go with me, you know, and I said, now you have to go to school. So I sent them to school, and I got in my car, and I knew that the treasure was at Evergreen Valley College. Now, mind you, I had never been to Evergreen Valley College in my life. I had only been living in the Bay Area, in this area, for about a year and a half, I guess. But I knew that's where it was, and I got all these directions on how to get there, and I drove out there, and I parked my car, and I knew I had to hurry up and find this treasure before anybody else got it. And so I parked the car, and I'm thinking, okay, now where am I supposed to go? And I should go up this hill, and I'm going up this hill, and I saw jackrabbits running across, and I looked down, and I saw all these people, and it looked to me like they were looking for the treasure, right? Because I saw people like, I don't know, maybe they were biology students or something, you know, looking for little bugs and stuff, and not really looking for the treasure under this tree. And I was up there, and I looked down, and there was this incredible, it was so incredibly beautiful that day. And I saw this like a pond. It had a little bridge going over it. And I saw people, and they were, you know, I was pretty far up there. They looked pretty small. And all of a sudden, this little voice said inside, this is where the treasure is. And I got filled with just this really warm feeling, like, God. And I thought and the prize was $1,500. And God, $1,500 at that time would have paid my rent for 3 months and I'd have had money left over. And I thought, you know, it's true. The treasure that I have been given in Alcoholics Anonymous is so much greater than this prize. The reality is that the $1,500, I'd had that gone in a minute. And the treasure that I've gotten beginning April Fool's Day 1975 continues to grow. Like someone was saying earlier, it's precious. You know, it's really, really precious. I would not trade the things that have happened in sobriety, the good and the bad, for anything. So I was just filled with this great, you know, happiness. And I was early enough to come to the noon meeting because I didn't have to dig up, you know, the ground or anything. And I came into the meeting and I was just excited, you know, and the meeting was just starting and somebody called on me and I told them I had gone on this treasure hunt and everybody was all excited and I said, but I didn't find that treasure. And people went, oh, and they were so disappointed for me. And I said, but I really have come to a knowing inside of myself that, that the treasures that we get in these rooms are so much more precious than that. And you know, it's true. Because during these years, I have had the opportunity to make a lot of money and spend a lot of money. You know, I mean, give away money, whatever. It's just, that's not the issue anymore. I have a job today that allows me to go in a lot of different directions. In fact, when I leave here, I have to go home and pack a suitcase to go to Denver to hire somebody for a position in Salt Lake City. And, you know, this makes me laugh because I was a cocktail waitress when I got sober and a part-time bookkeeper. And here, you know, I work for this corporation that, of course, they think that... that I've done a lot of management training, okay, over the years. And we get into problem solving a lot. And it's funny because, you know, our first step says, you know, we admit we're powerless over alcohol and that our life is unmanageable. And many times in management seminars or in just actual day-to-day problem solving, I'll start with the thing of saying, now look, do we really have a problem here? Is there really a problem? And are we really powerless over this? I mean, if not, why are we trying to fix it? Let's get over here. Well, yeah, and if we do have a problem, okay, do we believe this is resolvable? Do we believe it can be fixed? Well, yeah. Well, then why don't we turn it over to the appropriate department, you know? But first, we're going to have to write out a little description of what the problem is and what we're giving them. And then we have to leave it with them and let them fix it and do not keep interrupting them. And we need to also take a look at our side of the street and see if we had any contribution to this. And if so, then we better take steps to amend that, you know. And we need to monitor the situation, you know, just kind of keep paying attention to it, checking it out as we go along, trying to, you know, maybe meditate for new ideas and that. And then whatever solutions become apparent, we need to share that with everybody else in the corporation. And they go, my God, where do you get that stuff? Where do you get that? And finally I told them, I mean, they kept bugging me. These companies, many of you don't spend hundreds of thousands, probably millions, billions of dollars on training. And I love it. I mean, I'm a training junkie. But the thing is, they kept bugging. Finally I said, it's the Bill Wilson seminar. And they said, okay, if they ever come back to town, let us know. And we'll send the whole sales force. So the thing is that, you know, we get such incredible tools in here for living. I had no coping skills when I came to this program. My coping was to either leave town, which I did often, or make believe I had left town, which I did if I couldn't afford to leave town. And the way I did that was I would answer the phone and say, no, she doesn't live here anymore. You know, I mean, I had no way to communicate with people. I could talk a lot when I was drinking. And then especially when I found out that if I took speed and drank, I could talk a lot and drink a lot and, you know, stay up for 4 days and even, you know, vacuum the floor. But, you know, none of it had any substance and none of it meant anything. I think a lot about the traditions, and I think a lot of times that we don't hear enough about our traditions. And when I'm working with women that I sponsor, we talk a lot about the traditions because I think those are the foundation for our relationships with everybody. You know, the whole thing of if we learn how to have no opinions on outside interests. In fact, one year on New Year's Day, a bunch of us were sitting around, and, you know, even sober alcoholics think they know how to run the world, right? And we were having this conversation about how, you know, how the world should be. And we came up with the idea that wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody in the world was in a 12-step recovery program? And we decided we were going to run Jack Holt for president. We weren't going to run him. We were just going to appoint him like usually happens in AA, you know. And that we would be able to get rid of the IRS because we'd be self-supporting through our own contributions. We wouldn't be involved in any wars because we'd have no opinion on outside issues. There would be one authority, a loving God, as he expressed himself in the group conscience. We would be able to, you know, just kind of deal in a loving way. Our leaders would be trusted servants. They would not govern. And the operative word there is trusted. So we would be living kind of in a, you know, a paradise on earth. The only thing is, though, if that ever happened, and you'd have to plan about 4 hours to do your grocery shopping, because what happens now when you run into somebody in the program and you're out in the grocery store or the parking lot, right? Hug, hi, how are you? You have your little meeting. Can't you see it? You're going up and down the aisles. Okay. Put one thing in the basket. Hug, hi. Oh, hi. And oh, here's so-and-so. And did you see this? I mean, forever. Okay. I had the opportunity to experience just a little bit of that by going to the Montreal International Conference in 1980 and again in, or 1985 and again in 1990 in Seattle. And the ones coming up won't be that long in San Diego in 1995. So start saving your, you know, your dollars and quarters and dimes and plan to go. I wanted to talk a little bit too about some of the interesting people who've kind of come and gone in my life. Not necessarily just people in the program. I had an experience a couple of years ago. I was on my way down to Bakersfield to do a presentation. It wasn't an AA related thing, but it was kind of a talk at a church down there. And I was driving. I was getting on 101. You were Bernal. Goes on to 101. You're going south there. It's a real hot day. It must have been in the middle of the summer. And as I went past, I saw at the yield sign there, this guy was sitting there at the bottom of the sign. And I said, you know, God bless you. And I went out about a quarter of a block or so. And I thought, God, I'm getting so good about not thinking I have to save everybody, you know. And then I thought, well, I wonder how long he's been sitting there. And then I thought, God, you know, what if he's sick? And finally I said, all right, if I'm supposed to do something and he's still there, I will. So I made an illegal U-turn in the middle of the highway and went back. And sure enough, the guy was sitting there, and he got up and came over to the car. And at that time, Rancho Laguna Seca was still out there. It wasn't the women's facility yet. So I just assumed that he was trying to get out to the ranch. And the reason I assumed this was he was not in real good condition looking. You know, like, I mean, his hair was kind of all matted, and he had a beard, and it was obvious he hadn't showered for a long time. He had layers of clothing. And he had all his possessions in one yellow hip boot that people wear like when they're going fishing or something. And so I asked him, I said, are you going out to the ranch? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, get in and I'll give you a ride out there. Now, I don't do this all the time, okay? It's just like if I get a direction to do so. So we got in the car, and who was it was talking about not smelling real good? Let me tell you, I had my sunroof open and the two windows open, and I was trying to only breathe through my mouth because the guy smelled so bad. And I asked him what his name was, and he said, well, he was being Joseph for that day. And I said, oh, okay. And he asked me what my name was, and I said, Patricia. And he said, he has two sisters. One had a normal name, and the other one was Patricia. And he showed me he had tattooed, her name was tattooed on his arm. He had all these tattoos, and they weren't like jailhouse tattoos. I mean, they were very expensive tattoos all over. And I said, well, you know, do you keep in touch with your family? Well, no. He said, they won't come and visit him. And I said, well, it's not unusual. You know, where have you been living? Well, he'd been hanging in someplace at Tenderloin or something. I said, well, you know, I think it would be a good idea if you sent them postcards every now and then. They're probably worried about you. I said, well, okay. So then I asked him how old he was, and he said, well, you know, when you're born, they put numbers down on this paper. And I said, yeah. And he said, my numbers are, I think he said 1945 or something. And he said, how old do they think I am? And I said, well, yeah, 40 or whatever it was. And he said, no. He said, I think 27 is better. So I said, okay. So here's the guy. He's 27 years old in his mind, and his name is Joseph. And I said, you know, Joseph, do you drink? No. And I said, well, why are you going to the ranch? He said, what ranch? I said, aren't you going out here? And he said, oh, no. He said, I said, how long were you sitting there? He said, about a day. I said, well, how long would you have sat there if nobody came to pick you up? He said, I would just stay there until I got the idea to go someplace else. I said, okay. I said, he said, I don't drink, though, because the police get mad at you. Now, see, obviously this guy is not an alcoholic, because I never cared who got mad at me until I was sober, you know, and I think, oh, God, they're mad again. How can I make it up? He said, so he didn't drink. I think he may have had one too many hits of acid in the 60s or something, because he was, you know, not. So I gave him $20. He said he didn't need any money. He had plenty of money, and he opened up his little book, and there was some money in there. And I said, well, you know, keep it, because you might need it later. Give it to somebody else. So we're still driving along, and we're having this conversation. And I asked him, I said, well, Joseph, do you believe in God? And he said, I mean, and this is bizarre. This would be like somebody doing a movie, you know, a Fellini movie or something, this conversation. And he said, oh, yeah, he said, my parents paid for me to be parochial, so I believe in God and the saints. And I said, oh, that's good. So when you're out here wandering around, you won't feel alone. You know, you have some company. Well, yeah. Then I said, what do you do when you want to get cleaned up or something? You know. Oh, I know what it was. First, he said to me, do you think I could ever have a girlfriend? And I said, well, stranger things have happened. You probably would have to get cleaned up and get a job, you know. And I said, what do you do when you want to get cleaned up? Do you, like, go to Salvation Army or something? He said, oh, no. He said, I just go and I buy all new stuff, and then I just wear it until it wears out. And he said, for example, this. And he had one of his layers of clothing was this black and red Chinese silk kimono. Okay, it was black and it was trimmed in red. And he lifted it up and he showed it to me. He said, for example, this. He said, now, on the outside, this doesn't look very good. He said, but on the inside, it's really nice. And I said, well, isn't that the way it is with people? I said, sometimes maybe that's why you have problems, you know, with the police and that, because people are used to looking at the outside. And I thought, you know, I'm so grateful for what I have learned in these rooms, that on the inside is where we're all connected, that it's the thing, when we talk about identifying instead of comparing, when we're identifying with someone, we're identifying with the things inside. When we're comparing with the things outside. And identification connects us, and comparison separates us. And I thought, God, you know, this guy has no problem. He's fine. And it gave me some... I finally dropped him off down at 152 going towards Bakersfield. Thank God I did not take him all the way. And he wanted to give me his quilt. And it was like he had this reluctance to, you know, to leave. And it wasn't a negative kind of reluctance. It said, I think I was probably the first person in God knows how many years who talked to him at a heart level and treated him like he was a real person. And you know where I learned how to do that? Is in here, in rooms like this. I learned not to be afraid of people. I've had situations over the years where all of a sudden I could feel a situation go hostile, and you know, you just see the change in somebody's eyes. You think, oh my God. And what I have learned how to do is to go inside and focus on loving, and sending out loving vibrations instead of fear. I didn't know how to do that before. And I'm not saying get into AA and go save the world, you know, and wander around zoom, 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 and giving everybody good vibrations, because you have to use some common sense. But the things that I have learned in here have allowed me to move into situations with a tremendous amount of serenity and peace. And we talk about that in the promises also, that I used to have a poster that said, serenity is not freedom from the storm, but peace within it. And I have been through many a storm in my sobriety, I kid you not. But each thing today that goes on, I know that something good is happening. I have learned from you guys in these rooms that no matter what's going on right here. And it was just an incredible inspiration to me. And then no sooner had that happened than John Reed, who many of you know, died in early November, right before Thanksgiving. And, you know, there's a part of me that really, really misses both of them and is really sad. And there's another part of me that is just so grateful that I had the experience of knowing them and loving them and taking that risk to love. It's kind of interesting to me that we have very few early February birthdays. And I thought about, you know, we have a lot of April birthdays. And I think in late March, and I think the reason is that at Christmas and New Year's, people are thinking that they can really still handle it. No, who wants to quit before the holidays? I commend those of you who did. That takes real dedication. And what happens is, okay, the holidays are over and you have the New Year's resolution and you're going to stay sober. You're not going to stay sober. You're going to go on the wagon. And people struggle to stay on the wagon all through January. And then in February, some of them start going into treatment centers, and you know, or some of them just stay drunk a little bit longer. And then around March, St. Patrick's Day kept me drunk for two more weeks because I thought, well, I can't sober up before St. Patrick's Day, you know, being Irish and all. And finally, by April Fool's Day, people start, you know, getting a little bit of some sense of clarity. The month of February, though, we're talking about, you know, the idea that I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is love in expression. That when we come here and after you get the physical stuff out of your system, then the real work begins. And learning how to deal with life on life's terms, you know, we hear people say, well, I never lived life on life's terms. Well, yes, you did. We always live life on life's terms. But Alcoholics Anonymous gives us a way to do it a little bit gracefully without making ourselves nuts and committing homicide or suicide. The idea that we get these tools, and again, like with Joseph, he didn't have step one. He didn't have a problem. So it's important for me to understand that I do. I am powerless over alcohol. As long as it's not in my system, I'm okay. All of the other things that come up in life, I have learned how to deal with using the steps. I don't know. I share one other thing that I have never talked about at a meeting level before, and it sounds kind of weird, but when I was sober about 3 years, a friend of mine asked me to be godmother to her little girl who was getting baptized, and she was 7, and I said, God, you know, I'm not even on speaking terms with God. Are you sure you want to do this? She said, well, you're the most spiritual person I know. I had been in recovery for 3 years, and I had been working a spiritual program. And I said, well, okay. And about a month after that, she was going to make her first communion. And they said, would you come to the Mass? I said, okay. And I went. It was at this little church over by Valley Fair, and I was amazed at how crowded it was. It was just so crowded. And this little woman came up, and she spoke to me in Spanish, and she said, come up here. There's a seat up in front. And it didn't even cross my mind at the time that she wasn't speaking to me in English and why she would have thought I would have understood her, and I don't know. So I just went on up to the front, and I was in a pew maybe 3 back from the altar. And she explained to me that one of the kids in the class was a grandchild, and that these two other children in the pew were also her grandchildren. And one of them was a little girl who was about 10 years old, and she was deaf and mute. And this almost sounds like psychedelic. All of a sudden, I felt so much love for everybody in that church. And it was kind of like, everything was kind of like pink and gold and that. And I was thinking about this little girl, and I thought, God, if there was anything that I could do that would give her the gift of speech or hearing, I would do it. I mean, if a voice had said, get up and start walking to New York, I would have done it. But what the answer that I got was, this little girl has gifts that are connected with what she's doing here. And, you know, you don't need to know what that is. But you do have the gift of speech, and you do have the gift of hearing. And what you can do for her is make a commitment to treasure that. And you can make a commitment to listen with love and to try to speak with love. And that's what I have tried. And you know, for like 2 weeks, I wanted to go up to people on the street that I didn't even know. Okay, I just love you. And I thought, shut up. They will send you to Valley Net and lock you away. All right? But this feeling, just kind of persisted. And that commitment has stayed there. There have been a lot of times that I've had to tell people things that were not pleasant. Okay? And there have been times when I've had to love people enough that I sponsor to tell them the truth. But I believe that it can be done in a loving way And if the people who were here when I got here had not treated me with love and gentleness and kindness, I don't think I'd still be here. I think that we can tell our truth in a way that's kind. The question that I ask when some of the women will call with, should I say this or that, I ask them, is it necessary and is it kind? Okay. If it's necessary, say it kindly. The other thing is about listening. You know, to learn how to listen. We in Alcoholics Anonymous listen to each other at a heart level that is so different than you will ever hear anywhere. I mean, I have goosebumps right now talking about this kind of thing. It chokes me up. It makes me want to cry. The way that we learn how to really listen with our hearts to each other. And hopefully we can carry some of that over into the world out there. I have a tremendous gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that the answer to all my problems is in the steps. The answer to all my relationship problems is in the 12 traditions. The gifts I have been given, I can't even begin to name them. I've had some real tragedies, if I choose to call them tragedies, and that is that my middle sister, I was the eldest, and then the sister in the middle committed suicide when I had 6 years sober. And I thought I would die from the pain, but I didn't. And I didn't drink, and I didn't take anything, because it was too big. It was too big a hurt for that. And all through walking through that time, underneath it all, I knew that I was loved, I knew that I was going to be taken care of, and I knew that when I got to the other side of it, it was going to be okay. And you know, it has been, because walking through that experience has given me a tremendous compassion for people who are going through the same kind of stuff. I've been able to share my experience, strength, and hope that way with people who have lost someone close to them through suicide. A couple of years ago, I had just gotten back from a women's conference in Minneapolis, and I got off the plane, and my son was at the airport, and I thought, what's he doing here? And I walked up to him, and he said, Mom, something terrible happened today. And I said, what? And he said, Emily Ann died, and that was my little granddaughter who had just turned 4 months. And it was like, I just immediately went into denial, you know, no, 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 no. And yet, you know, walking through that whole process too and watching my son and daughter-in-law walk through that, they were at an AA meeting that night. They were immersed in this program, in the fellowship. And it allowed them to not have to take anything and to get better. And each time something like that happens, I know in the middle of it, I allow myself to feel it. I allow myself to feel the feelings. But I also know that it's going to get better. You know, the worst thing that ever happened to me got better. The worst thing that ever happened to me was finding out I was an alcoholic. Okay? That was the end of my life, the end of the road. The party was all over, finished. And that turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. And I'm finding out that time after time after time, the worst thing that happens to me is the best thing that happens to me. Because it either forces me into change, it forces me to God, it forces me closer to God every time, it forces me to be closer to you guys. You know, I can't do this by myself. And thank God I know today that I don't have to. I sent a letter out recently at work. It's really funny because I have people with all these letters who report to me. They have letters after their names and they report to me, and I think it's a kick because, like I said, little do they know. And I sent out a letter. It said, Patricia Gallagher, HP. And so I got several calls back. What does this HP mean? I said, it means happy person. And, you know, that's the truth of it, that Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to be happy. It's allowed me to risk trying new things, going new places, embracing new experiences. I would not have done any of this. I guarantee you, had I continued the way I was going, I know I would not be here today. I'm so grateful to know that I'm an alcoholic, and I'm so grateful for all of you being here. And I hope that you'll all keep coming back, because this is a week program. We can't do it by ourselves. Thanks.